Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Greetings and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scarsbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. 1957, connecting Pope Pius XII to the Treaty of Rome. Centuries to celebrate for the Pontifical Irish College here in Rome. And what climate change in the Himalayas could possibly have in common with the obelisk in St. Peter's Square. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. It was the 25th of March 1957 when, in the aftermath of the Second World War, our European family was established. 50 years on, we're coming even closer together with integration and expansion from 6 to 27 countries. While remaining diverse in culture, language and traditions, our unity is based on common values. Freedom, democracy, the rule of law, respect for human rights and equality. But while clearly we have a lot to celebrate 50 years later, have you ever wondered who was Pope at the time of that treaty? Should we listen to his voice?
We welcome the opportunity to say a word of praise and encouragement for those who are most certainly in the forefront of the champions of a Christ cause in your country.
The voice of Pius XII, the man who was Roman pontiff at the time of the signing of the first Treaty of Rome half a century ago. The recording is a rare one, picked from less than a handful of papal radio messages in English, broadcast through the microphones of our radio station, the very same year of that historic signature, 1957, offering us a taste of that era.
Catholics have the noble and the truly patriotic task and ambition to help that public opinion to find and hold to the path of truth and justice, and let us say it simply and honestly, holy living. If you succeed in this, we'll have made a momentous contribution to the peace, prosperity, and the power for good of your beloved country.
Like everyone else at the time, Pope Pius XII must have closely followed this historic event taking place on Rome's Capitoline Hill, right across the Tiber River. And a couple of months later, he was to address a large group of European parliamentarians in private audience. As protocol dictated, the event was not recorded by our radio station, but the Pope's speech was safely archived. Clearly at the heart of this address was his concern regarding the new chapter in European history. It was the 13th of June 1957, and in the Vatican's Sala Regia, thousands of politicians had gathered around Pius XII. Among them, the president of the Movement for European Unity of the time, today considered to be the father of Europe, his name Robert Schuman. Together with him, politicians from more than 16 European nations in Rome for a European Congress, taking place in the aftermath of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. All may have had European unity at heart, but not all were from the 6 signatory nations of the historical international agreements that had taken place on 25th of March of that year. Namely France, the Federal Republic of Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and of course the host country Italy. Speaking in French, the language of diplomacy, Pius XII highlighted the importance of Europe's Christian roots. Laying down the foundations of Europe, which has so often witnessed bloody conflicts, he said, may require patience, but is impelling for lasting cohesion in this historic mission. Human societies, the Pope stressed, are always in the making, and Christianity gives them that element of growth and stability necessary to guide the march towards a set goal and the certainty of a nation which is not of this world. One where union will be perfect because it comes from the force and light of God. Among your duties, Pius XII added finally, is the ratification of the Treaty of Rome and, eventually, the drawing up of a constitution for this unique political organism. Who knows, perhaps it was this particular audience or the signing of the Treaty of Rome to inspire Pius XII to compose a special prayer for Catholic parliamentarians and politicians only months later. Calling on God, creator of heaven and earth, to inspire Catholic politicians to distinguish the just from the unjust as a reflection of divine wisdom.
One's inward vision, they must be lifted up from the dark, confusing complexities of a passing world, to keep steadily in view the sheer white light of eternity.
My thanks go to our Vatican Radio sound engineers, as always, for making this program possible. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, let's turn to the Irish for another celebration, that of the Pontifical Irish College here in Rome. But before focusing on this event with the current rector of the college, let's take a look briefly at the figure of St. Patrick, why he has such an appeal, and why, if it's true that we conjure up images of shamrocks and beer-drinking havoc when we think of the day we dedicate to him each year, it's also just as true that devotion of this apostle to Ireland is also linked to one of the most grueling penitential rites in the Catholic Church, as my colleague Emma McCarthy discovered from Monsignor Liam Bergin.
Patrick brought the good news to the Irish people in the 4th century, and it's something we've cherished ever since. Patrick was a missionary to Ireland, and I think he has inspired the Irish to be missionaries throughout the centuries since. Like all religious feasts nowadays, it's very difficult to keep the religious separate from the secular or from even other material aspects. But because Patrick captures the imagination of the Irish and many more, I think it probably has been that little bit easier. Say, if you think of in Italy, we've just celebrated Carnevale, and much of the religious significance of this event has been totally lost. But Patrick, bishop, and the figure, you know, with the shamrock, still stands tall despite everything else.
A very interesting point, the idea of separating the spiritual from the secular, this celebration of the feast day.
Well, I think the best example we can take is Patrick himself. Patrick came a Christian to pagan Ireland. And what did he do? He looked at the beliefs the Irish had already and tried to bring them along to understand the Christian message. The pre-Christian Irish had a great sense of creation and of the elements. And the two great symbols Patrick used were fire and creation, the shamrock, the pagan festival of fire. Patrick transformed that with the Easter Vigil, taking that ancient ritual of the pagans and baptizing it, if you want, turning it into the Easter Vigil. And the same way, the great love that the ancient Irish have for creation, Patrick took, you know, one of the smallest plants we have on our land, the shamrock, and used that to explain the Trinity. So I think that's the example we take. Find people where they are, and try and, if you like, baptize or reconvert different practices that may be out there today, even still.
Beyond Ireland, he's a saint that is celebrated also in America, in Australia, in places as far off as the Philippines. What is his appeal?
Well, would you believe, in Nigeria, it's also a solemnity, the Feast of St. Patrick, because they were evangelised by the Irish. But even here in Italy, there are extraordinary connections. Patrick, down through the centuries, has had a great fascination for people, and particularly his great penitential exercise in Lough Derg. Many of your listeners may know that, you know, the most severe penitential exercise in the church is Lough Derg. That's a three-day exercise on an island on the northwest of Ireland, where people go without food, go barefoot, and even without a night's sleep in penance, following the example of Patrick. And here in Italy, there are different shrines which commemorate Patrick's purgatory and Patrick's intercession. It's believed that hundreds of Italians, thousands indeed, would have gone from Italy to Ireland to do this exercise during medieval times. And there are two great testimonies to that. In Orvieto, there is the Pozzo di San Patrizio, the well of St. Patrick, which again is linked to the whole story of the purgatory. It is believed that St. Patrick brought the pagan Irish to the edge of a well, and he touched the well with his crozier. And when they looked down, they could see right down to the centre of the earth and could see the souls in purgatory. And that's how he explained it to them.
We begin celebrations to mark the foundation of the Pontifical Irish College here in Rome. Would you just like to explain to our listeners how the Pontifical Irish College came about being founded?
Well, immediately after the Reformation, the situation for Catholics in Ireland, England, Wales, indeed many of the countries in Northern Europe became very difficult. It was illegal to have a seminary. It was illegal for Catholics to receive any education. So what they did was they moved their activity off land, offshore, and opened colleges throughout Europe. Once upon a time, or in the 17th, 18th century, there were about 30 Irish colleges scattered over Europe, from Portugal to Poland, from Italy up to the Spanish Netherlands. There were colleges in many, many cities, because, again, it was illegal to have colleges in Ireland. The Irish College in Rome is the only one that still exists, because obviously we can have seminaries and education in Ireland now. But the Irish College in Rome is the only Irish seminary that still exists in Europe. And we were founded in 1628 by an Irish Franciscan called Luke Wadding and an Italian cardinal, Ludovico Ludovisi. And an extraordinary thing happened is that both of them died on the same day, but 25 years apart. And this year is the anniversary, the 350th anniversary of the death of Wadding, and the 375th anniversary of the death of Ludovisi. So yes, we hope to celebrate our founders and hopefully to reconsolidate their legacy as this year progresses.
Now, this is going to take place in various ceremonies throughout Europe. I believe the first opening of the celebrations will take place in Louvain. From then it will be in Bobbio, and lastly here in the Irish College. How are you going to celebrate or mark the anniversaries?
Well, Wadding was a great European. He was from a wealthy merchant family in Waterford in Ireland. And as a young man, he went to do his commercial activity in Portugal because it was not possible as a Catholic in Ireland. In Portugal, he became a Franciscan. And then he travelled greatly throughout Europe. The Irish College in Louvain, we had a college in Louvain until the First World War. It is now an Irish cultural institute. But that was founded 400 years ago this year by Wadding. And Wadding would have come down through Europe and would have had a great influence in many places.
There's an extremely strong Irish presence here in Rome, and it really is felt. How many churches do we have right now that are in Rome, in the city itself, that are guided, spiritually guided by the Irish community, the Irish priests here?
Well, we have the Irish College, which is right beside St. John Lateran on the Via dei Santi Quattro. Then St. Patrick's Church, Augustinian Church, on Via Boncompagni. And then everybody who comes to Rome knows San Clemente, which is under the care of the Irish Dominicans. And this is a particular anniversary for them too, because this year celebrates the 150th anniversary of the discovery of that extraordinary rich excavation site beneath the church, found by an Irish Dominican priest 150 years ago this year. Then we have San Silvestro, traditionally the English church in Rome, but it is staffed by the Irish Palatine Fathers. We are still strong here in the city.
Was the rector of the Pontifical Irish College here in Rome, Monsignor Liam Bergin, speaking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. Our thanks go to both of them. And finally, it's time for our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover, whom I quiz today about climate change in the Himalayas.
but inevitably ends up speaking to me about a Roman emperor.
Were the Romans environmentalists, do you think?
No. I mean, they saw some things had to be done, you know, like canals built and...
lakes drained.
Yeah, that they understand, but, you know, world climate and world warming, they didn't.
Well, they wouldn't have. They wouldn't have screamed from rooftops that God,
no,
that
no.
God is green.
No, no,
how'd
no.
How'd you say that in Latin?
What, that God is green? It was really disaster.
They wouldn't have screamed from rooftops.
Domorum fastigius, non exclamavicent. Would not have screamed, Deus vidi disest, God is green. They would not have done that. Well, no one understood that stuff in those days.
Well, maybe the Stoics would have done
that. They had a vision of the world complex, the Stoics did. Mm. But I don't know about ecology, I don't know.
They believed in
The totality of creation, they did. Mm. Yes, they did.
Mm. Were there lots of Stoics around in Roman times?
Oh, there always were. Of course, Seneca was the big one, the big Roman representative of Stoicism.
Okay, well, let's dedicate this piece to Seneca. I'm going to take you to the rooftop of the world. What's that?
You Where know is that? That?
The Himalaya.
Okay.
How do you say the rooftop?
Orbis cacumine, in the highest point of the world.
I'm going to tell you something that will make your skin crawl. Huh. How do you say making one's skin crawl in Latin?
What does that mean?
Feeling skin uncomfortable. Crawl. It makes you cringe. I don't know.
Faccia ad nescio ego nescio. Bene. Go on.
You won't answer my questions. I'm going to speak about the Himalaya melting. Glacial lakes, this is an article I found, pose a new peril as ice turns to water. So how do you say that?
Lacus glaciales novum afferunt periculum. Ice turns to water.
Yeah.
Glaciae in aquam transiunte. Ice turning over into water.
This is an alarm. This is a real alarm. This is serious stuff. How do you say this is serious stuff? It's a real alarm.
Proxime seria.
Alarm? How do you say alarm?
Est admonitio gravissima. I don't know anything about the Himalayas.
In 1994, a mile-long glacial lake near Bhutan's border with Tibet ruptured catastrophically. And how do you say rupturing catastrophically?
Oh, my Lord. What is the lake ruptus est in calamitatem? Mm.
Over a period of several hours, just think, the entire lake, more than a billion cubic feet of water, emptied out, sending a rampaging torrent down valley that swept away an artisan's colony near the town of Punaka, killing 23 people. Okay, let's just translate. More than a billion cubic feet of water emptied out, sending...
Oh, I just say a billion, you can't say this. Well, you can say it in Latin.
You can write it.
You can write it. You can say Milena, Milia... cuborum cuborum aquae evacuae facta sunt. We're emptied.
Emptied out, sending a rampaging torrent down valley that swept away
Quae
a village.
Torrentem devastantem in valem direxerunt.
Global warming has forced into retreat virtually all of these thousands of glaciers.
Hey, global warming, they're going, calefactio planetae in recessum coagit. What?
Yes, global what? Warming has forced into retreat virtually all of these glaciers, which are shrinking.
Denique tandem omnes, glaciarum moles.
During the Little Ice Age, which ended as recently as 150 years ago, glaciers slowly bulldozed horseshoe-shaped rubble and ice down valley. So let's translate. Little Ice Age.
Many, many, many parva glaciae etas.
Changing the subject. The Romans had ice houses, didn't they?
No.
Yes, he did.
Ice houses, where?
He didn't. Okay.
I mean, where? There wasn't much ice unless they were up in the North Pole and where there's ice.
They kept ice in the Alps. They kept ice. They took it from the snow and they put it into houses.
I understand, but they had ice houses like the Eskimos is another story.
I mean houses where they kept ice.
Oh, ice houses, not ice houses. Well, yeah, they used the ice in their wine and they imported ice. And you were supposed to put ice in your wine.
They eat ice creams.
Cool. They had all that stuff.
Lemon sorbets.
Yeah. I don't know how they kept the ice. They kept it in salt or something like that.
Getting back to our little ice age, glaciers slowly bulldozed horseshoe-shaped rubble and ice down valley. Moraines. Horseshoe-shaped moraines. Too difficult.
Well, it's not. You can describe it. Propellerunt terram et solum in formam calcae quini, a horse's shoe, which means nothing, of course.
Well, it's curved.
Yeah, okay.
The moraine, which is this rubble, this material, is turned into the geologic equivalent of Swiss cheese.
Oh, my Lord, deliver us. Ecterum transfigurator in id quod, into that which Casius Helveticus digitur, is called Swiss cheese.
It's sad.
Oh, that's enough.
It's terrible, isn't it? I told you it would make your skin crawl.
You can do it. You just have to think for a moment, heaven's sakes alive.
Now, let's go for a walk in the Himalaya now. We wander through lush yak meadows.
And what is yak? I don't know what a yak is.
We wander through lush meadows. How do you say that?
Florida, ambulamos per prata.
Ravens clack and prattle.
Oh, Lord, deliver us. Ravens are what? Corvi croccant et jablaterant. That's not the right word, but anyway.
As they wheel above us.
Circumvolantes, that's all right.
And I scan the surrounding peaks with my binoculars.
Et perspicillo meo per lustro apices circumdantes. That I can say.
Are you concerned about the environment?
No, I don't feel it. I'm sorry.
What worries you most about the environment? The lack of water that we're going to get? Or
no,
flooding?
I don't know this. I don't know this. Here in Rome, I just don't see it. I don't see this. I don't see the emergency. From the newspapers, everyone's talking about this. And they had pictures the other day how low the Tiber is. Well, then, of course, you say, ooh, I don't know what's going on.
Claudius built a channel to go to the port of Ostia, didn't he?
He built a harbour out at Ostia, where he sunk the famous ship there as a lighthouse. Mm. He didn't build a channel. He built a harbour out there. He extended the harbour of Ostia, like the river, and he put a whole new thing out there, which they discovered a few years ago, you know. You know, the famous ship that brought the obelisk at St. Peter's?
Mm-hmm.
So that was Caligula? And they built the biggest ship in the world? To transport this thing? You didn't know this?
No, I never know anything.
From Alexandria, Cairo in Egypt, down the Nile, up to Rome? Well, they had about 25,000 bushels of lentils or something as ballast. It was the biggest ship in the world to get that thing at St. Peter's Square here to Rome. About 40 tons or whatever the thing is, I don't even know. Which Caligula did. And of course the ship is sitting there. They got the thing and they got the obelisk here in the Circus of Nero, parallel to St. Peter's Basilica today. But anyway, this ship is sitting out there. at Ostia of a city near this massive thing, the biggest ship in the world. Well, Claudius, intelligent man, said, I'm going to use this ship as part of my breakwater. No, he was going to build this new harbor, which he did. And he said, part of the breakwater way out there, I'm going to sink this ship and put a lighthouse on it, which is extremely intelligent.
Was that the first lighthouse ever?
Yeah, I mean, for the Romans, yes.
How does one say lighthouse?
Pharos, which of course, Pharos in the east, one of the wonders of the world. And so Claudius had this ship sunk with stones and everything else and supported below with pillars. You can't believe this thing. This is Claudius. It's very beautiful. It's all described in Suetonius. And then he had a tower put, instead of like the mast of the ship, he had a tower put up there. And on the top of the tower, he had a place for fires. And at night, he had people lighting fires up there so that the ships coming in could see the fire and direct their journey into the harbor. This is Claudius.
How do you say all that in Latin?
Oh, I'm not going to say it all right now. And the fact is, if you go to Ostia right now, you can see mosaics there, you know, in the square of the corporations. And you see this thing like an island and this tower and fires up on top. And those were the fires of Claudius's lighthouse out at Ostia. They found about a few years ago, they found some of the foundations of these things out in the water.
Amazing.
Oh, out of this world. It was extremely intelligent. He didn't know what to do with this ship. And so he sunk the whole thing like an island. It was so big. He sunk the thing and put a lighthouse on the top with fires there. And he said, you know, Incendius or something, navicola dirigerentur, that the ships would be, or navicolae, would be directed by the fires on the top of the tower. And you can still see, as I say, in Ostia, if you go out there, you see these mosaics all over the place, and one of the symbols, almost like a postage stamp, of Ostia, was this like an island with this tower and the fires up on top, which was Claudius's lighthouse. And we're so smart today, we're not smart at all.
Yeah, well, we would need the Romans to deal with our environmental problem. How'd you say that?
Yeah. Ejuremus hodie Romanus qui difficultatem nostram ambituum vel locorum. A solvent.
They would solve our problems. They would have found a solution to
They were very practical.
To the lakes.
Very, very practical.
In the Himalayas.
They weren't philosophical like the Greeks, you know, and art and dancing and all music. They didn't understand that stuff. But they were extremely practical.
They were engineers, in a sense. The engineer mentality.
And the organizers and laws and streets and all that stuff. Ooh, the Romans were good.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.